Chapter 4. We can get you a woman to keep you warm at night. The London offices of BCG were right above the Green Park tube stop on the Piccadilly line in the heart of Mayfair. I presented myself at reception and was shown into John Lindquist's corner office, which resembled that of an absent-minded professor with books and papers stacked everywhere. When I laid eyes on him, I could immediately see that John was something of an anomaly. An American, he looked like a more refined version of Chip or Winthrop in his Savile Row suit, Hermes tie, and horn-rimmed glasses. But he also had a bookish awkwardness about him. Unlike his blue-blooded juniors at J.P. Morgan, John had a soft, almost whisper-like voice and never made direct eye contact. After getting settled in his office, he said, "The people in Chicago tell me you want to work in Eastern Europe, right? You're the first person I've ever met at BCG who wants to work there." "Yes, believe it or not, that's what I want to do." "Why?" I told him the story of my grandfather, how he'd lived in Moscow and then returned to the United States and ran for president and became the face of American communism. "I want to do something interesting like him. Something that's relevant to me and who I am." "Well, we've never had a communist working at BCG before," he said with a wink. He straightened. "At the moment, we don't have anything happening in Eastern Europe, but I'll tell you what. If you come work here, I promise that the first piece of Eastern European business that comes our way will be yours, right?" I quickly guessed that he said, "right," at the end of almost every sentence, as if it were a tick. I couldn't pinpoint why, but I liked John. I accepted his offer on the spot and became the first employee in BCG's East European practice group. I moved to London in August 1989 and rented a small house in Chelsea with two of my Stanford classmates who were also starting new jobs in London. On the first Monday in September, I hopped on the Piccadilly line with butterflies in my stomach, ready to take on Eastern Europe at BCG. Only, as John had explained, there wasn't any work in Eastern Europe. Not yet, anyway. But then, on November 10th, 1989, as I sat in my tiny living room watching television with my Stanford buddies, the world shifted beneath my feet. The Berlin Wall had just come down. East and West Germans had emerged with sledgehammers and chisels and begun breaking it down, chunk by chunk. We watched as history unfolded before our eyes. Within weeks, the Velvet Revolution took hold of Czechoslovakia, and the communist government fell. The dominoes were falling, and clearly soon all of Eastern Europe would be free. My grandfather had been the biggest communist in America, and as I watched these events unfold, I decided that I wanted to become the biggest capitalist in Eastern Europe. My first break came in June 1990, when John Lindquist popped his head in my office and said, "Hey, Bill, you're the one who wanted to go to Eastern Europe, right?" I nodded. "Excellent. The World Bank is looking for restructuring advisors to go to Poland. I need you to put together a proposal for turning around a failing Polish bus company, right?" "Okay, but I've never done a proposal before. What should I do?"
"Go to Wolfgang. He'll tell you."
Wolfgang. Wolfgang Schmidt. Just hearing his name made my skin crawl. Wolfgang was a BCG manager who led some of the case teams day to day. He was widely considered one of the most difficult managers to work for in the London office. A 30-something Austrian, he enjoyed shouting, forced all-nighters, and chewing up and spitting out young consultants. Nobody wanted to work for him. But if I really wanted to go to Poland, then I would have to work for Wolfgang. I had never been to his office, but I knew where it was. Everyone did, if for no other reason than to avoid it. I walked there and found a complete mess. His room was strewn with empty pizza boxes, crunched-up papers, and piles of report. Wolfgang was hunched over a 3-ring binder, running his finger along the page. His sweaty brow glowed in the fluorescent light, and his unkempt hair shot out at different angles. His expensive English shirt was untucked, his bare and round stomach peeking out on one side. I cleared my throat. He cocked his head in my direction.
Who are you?
Bill Browder.
What do you want? Can't you see I'm busy?
I thought that he should have been busy cleaning the sty that passed for his office, but didn't say as much. I need to prepare a proposal for a Polish bus company restructuring. John Lindquist told me to talk to you.
Christ, he mumbled. Listen, Browner, start by finding resumes of BCG consultants who have experience in trucks, buses, cars. Whatever you think could be related. Get as many as you can.
Okay, should I bring them back to you?
Just do it!
He returned to his binder and resumed reading. I left his office and went to the library. Flipping through the resume book, I saw why BCG had such an amazing international reputation. They were people with experience in every field and in every corner of the globe. A team of consultants in the Detroit office were experts in automobile manufacturing. A group from Tokyo had worked on just-in-time inventory implementation for Japanese car companies. And some consultants in Los Angeles were specialists on operations research. I photocopied these and quickly returned to Wolfgang's office.
Back so soon, Brauer.
It's Browder, actually.
Yeah, listen. There's a couple other Polish assignments coming up as well. The guys doing those proposals will tell you what to do. I don't have time for this. Now, if you don't mind...
Wolfgang flicked an open hand at the doorway, indicating I should leave. I found the other consultants, and thankfully they were more than happy to lend a hand. Over the next few weeks, we made timetables, work plans, and compiled more information about what a great firm BCG was. When we were done, the presentations were so polished and slick that I didn't see how we could possibly lose. We handed them over to John Lundquist, who submitted them to the World Bank, and we all waited. 2 months later, Wolfgang came by my office looking uncharacteristically cheerful and put together.
Bill, pack your bags. You're going to Poland.
We won.
We did indeed. Now the real work begins.
I was elated. Should I start calling the experts we put in the proposal to make sure they can come to Poland as well? Wolfgang furrowed his eyebrows.
What are you talking about? Of course not. You're the only one who's going to be working on this case.
He clapped his hand on the doorframe, turned, and stomped off. I couldn't believe it. I had put all those impressive people in the proposal, and the Poles were getting only me? A first-year associate who knew absolutely nothing about buses, or business for that matter. I was appalled, but I kept my misgivings to myself. This was my dream assignment. I was just going to bite my tongue and make it work. In late October 1990, nearly a year after the Berlin Wall came down, John, Wolfgang, two other first-year associates, and I boarded a LOT Airlines flight, the Polish national airline, bound for Warsaw. There we were met by four men from the World Bank and two employees from Autosan, the troubled bus company we were supposed to help save from bankruptcy. After retrieving our luggage, we boarded one of Autosan's buses and made our way to its headquarters in Sanok. It was a long ride. Warsaw quickly gave way to the Polish countryside, which was in the throes of autumn. It was picturesque, but also a little depressing. Poland's communist regime had recently collapsed, and conditions on the ground were harsher than I expected. It was like stepping into a time machine set to 1958. The cars were ancient. Horses pulled carriages on the roadside. Farms were dilapidated, and the housing in towns, those ubiquitous concrete blocks in the Soviet style, were crumbling. The Poles suffered from food shortages, hyperinflation, electricity blackouts, and all sorts of other dysfunctions. Yet as I sat in the rumbling bus with my forehead pressed against the glass, I thought, this is exactly where I want to be. The road ahead was open and full of possibility. 6 hours later, we arrived in Sanok, a town of less than 50,000 in the wooded and hilly southeastern corner of Poland, 10 miles from the Ukrainian border. We arrived at Autosan's company restaurant and made our way inside for a banquet with Autosan's management team and some executives from the World Bank. None of the guests wanted to touch the meal. Greasy pork chops, overboiled potatoes, and some kind of savory gelatin containing bits of pork. In addition to the unappetizing food, an underlying odor of industrial solvent from the nearby factory wafted through the air. I got the feeling that everyone who was not from Sanok wanted to get out of there as quickly as possible. The bus company management wasn't going to let us go, however, and continued with toasts and anecdotes well into the evening. Finally, at 11:15, as the coffee was being served, the World Bank team awkwardly rose, made their excuses, climbed back on the bus, and took it to Rzeszów, the closest town with a decent hotel. My BCG colleagues waited until the World Bank team was safely out of sight, before they also rose and made their excuses. They went outside, and Wolfgang negotiated with two taxi drivers to take them the whole 6 hours back to Warsaw that night. I was the only one left, a 26-year-old MBA with 1 year of consulting experience, to save this company from disaster. After coffee, I said my goodbyes to the management, who didn't seem to understand that I was a nobody compared to everyone who had just left. I was then escorted to the Hotel Turista, which would be my home for the next few months. The Turista was a musty, four-story concrete building a couple of blocks from the San River. It had no elevator, so I had to take the stairs. The passageway was narrow and dimly lit, and my room was tiny, more hall than room. It had two twin beds that were pushed against opposite walls, and the only floor space was the gap between them. Bolted to the wall over one of the beds was a 13-inch black-and-white television. A plain chintzy end table was pushed between the beds. On top of this was a single lamp. Above the lamp was a small window that overlooked a vacant lot. It wasn't the Four Seasons, but I was so excited to be in Poland that I didn't care. I tried the white plastic rotary phone to see if it worked, but the line connected only to the matronly woman at the front desk who didn't speak a word of English. I unpacked, stuffing my clothes into the wardrobe. The room was cold and the radiator wasn't working, so I put on the parka I'd brought for the upcoming winter. I turned on the TV. There were only 3 stations, all in Polish. One channel was news, one was soccer, and one was some show about sheep. I turned off the TV. I fiddled fruitlessly with the dial of a shortwave radio I'd brought, but found nothing and gave up. I got into bed and tried to sleep, but it was simply too cold. I tapped the radiator and turned the valve near the floor, but no heat came. Normally, I would have called the front desk, but given the language barrier, that wouldn't have helped. I got some more clothing out of my wardrobe and pulled the blankets off the other bed and buried myself under all of it. Even though I was still wearing my parka, this didn't work either. I tossed and turned all night and barely slept. When the sun began to rise, I turned on the shower, hoping that at least would warm me. I waited and waited for the stream of hot water, but it never got better than lukewarm. I skipped the shower, got dressed, and went down to the Turista's small restaurant to meet my translator for the first time. A trim man in an ill-fitting gray polyester suit stood bolt upright as soon as I appeared. He tucked a rolled-up newspaper under an arm and extended a hand. "Mr. William!" I took his hand. "Yes, that's me." "Hello, my name is Leszek Sikorski," he said enthusiastically. Leszek, a few years older and a little taller than me, had light brown hair, bright green eyes, and a neatly trimmed beard. In different circumstances, he might have been good-looking, but the bad suit and his crooked teeth dashed that possibility.
"Please sit," Leszek motioned toward a chair. "How was your sleep?" he asked, nearly shouting at the end of the sentence.
"Cold, actually. There was no heat in the room."
"Yes, they don't turn it on until winter officially starts,"
he again shouted the last word. He spoke English so unnaturally that I was certain he'd learned it from a set of Berlitz tapes. The waitress showed up and poured me a cup of tea, while Leszek told her something in Polish. When she disappeared, I asked, "What did you say to her?"
"To bring you the breakfast."
"Is there a menu?"
"No, no, only one breakfast."
A few minutes later, breakfast arrived. Overcooked sausages and some strange Polish processed cheese. I was so hungry that I choked it all down. Leszek ate his meal dutifully, neither disgusted nor excited. Midway through the meal, his mouth full of food, he asked,
"You are from London, yes?"
"That's right." A smile spread across his face.
"Then I have a favor to ask."
He lowered his voice and whispered,
"Can you introduce me to Samantha Fox?"
Samantha Fox was a busty English pop singer who'd gotten her start by modeling topless on page 3 of the British tabloid, The Sun. I gave Leszek a funny look. "I'm afraid not. I don't know her." He leaned back in his chair with a doubtful look and insisted,
"But you must. You're from London."
"Leszek, I wish I could help, but there are 7 million people in London." I didn't want to be rude, but this was ridiculous. How was I going to turn around a failing bus company if my main connection to the outside world was this strange guy obsessing about a topless model from England? After breakfast, Leszek and I left the hotel and folded ourselves into the tiny red Polski Fiat that the bus company had provided for me during my stay. After several attempts, I got the engine to sputter to life. Leszek smiled as he directed me to Autosan's headquarters, a 7-story white concrete building near the river. We parked, and as I passed into the lobby, I detected the same unpleasant smell of industrial solvents from dinner the night before. Leszek and I took the elevator to the top floor and found our way to the general manager's office. The general manager stood in the doorway like a barricade, his broad shoulders taking up nearly the whole space, his thick mustache perched over a beaming smile. He appeared to be twice my age and had worked at Autosan for his entire career. As I drew near, he stuck out the thick-fingered hand of a laborer, and when I took it, he squeezed so hard it felt as if my small hand had been trapped in a wringer. He ushered Leszek and me into his office and began speaking quickly in Polish.
"Welcome to Sanok," Leszek translated, talking over him. "He wants to know if you would like some brandy to toast your arrival."
"No, thank you," I said awkwardly, wondering if I was making some cultural faux pas by rejecting his offer of hard liquor at 10 a.m. The general manager then launched into a speech that once again expressed his excitement that I was there. He explained that Autosan was Sanok's main employer. If the company failed, then the town would also fail. He and everyone else at Autosan thought that BCG, and by default, me, was going to save the whole lot from financial ruin. I tried to look serious and nodded at all of this, attempting to convey some semblance of confidence, but inwardly I was completely mortified by the scope of my responsibility. When he finished his little speech, he said,
"Mr. Browder, before you get to work, I must ask, is there anything we can do to make your stay in Sanok more pleasant?"
From the moment I'd walked into his office, I had realized how warm it was, especially after my fitful night in my freezing room. I noticed a quietly buzzing space heater in the corner that emitted a comforting orange glow. Eyeing it, I nervously asked, "Do you think I could get a heater like that one for my room, sir?" There was a moment of silence as Leszek translated. Then the general manager's face lit up. With rosy cheeks, he winked and said,
Mr. Browder, we can do much better than that. We can get you a woman to keep you warm at night.
I looked sheepishly at my shoes and stammered, No, thank you, a space heater will be just fine. I promptly got to work, and my first week in Poland was the biggest culture shock I had experienced in my life. Everything in Sanok, the smells, the language, the customs, was different. But what made it particularly hard for me was the food. The only available meat was pork, and it was ubiquitous. Sausage for breakfast, ham sandwiches for lunch, pork chops for dinner, every single day. There were no fruits or vegetables. Chicken was a delicacy. Worst of all, every single meal was drenched in heavy grease, as if this were some kind of magical condiment that made everything more palatable, which it didn't. By day 5, I was starving. I had to do something, and decided to go to Warsaw and check into the Marriott to get some decent food. As soon as I arrived, I dropped my bag in the room and headed for the restaurant. I had never been so happy to be at a hotel buffet in my life. I scooped piles of salad, fried chicken, roast beef, cheese, and French bread onto my plate, and ate like a man possessed. I went back for seconds, and then thirds. By the time I was ready for dessert, my stomach started to rumble, and I knew that if I didn't hurry to a bathroom, I would be in trouble. I made my way to the men's room as fast as I could, but just as I was crossing the lobby, there was Wolfgang Schmidt standing right in front of me.
Brauner, what the hell are you doing in Warsaw? He demanded.
I was so surprised to see him that I didn't know what to say. I just figured that since it was Friday night...
Friday night? He barked. Are you kidding? You need to get your ass back to Sanok.
Sanok, I corrected, shifting uncomfortably from foot to foot.
Whatever the fuck. You need to get back there and integrate yourself with the clients on the weekend. That's how this business works.
The gas in my stomach was so intense, I barely heard Wolfgang. Okay, I'll go back. Sorry, really, I am. The bathroom was right there, and time was wasting.
All right, Brauner.
When he finally stepped aside, I hurried toward the toilet at full speed. After the Wolfgang run-in, I was so intimidated that I didn't dare set foot in Warsaw again. Instead, on weekends, I drove my little Polsky Fiat around the countryside, foraging for food. I would stop at small restaurants, and since I didn't speak a word of Polish, pointed 3 or 4 random entrees on the menu, hoping that one would be edible. I prayed for chicken, and occasionally got it. I could afford to do this because the Polish zloty was so depressed that each dish cost the equivalent of 45 cents. It was fun to get out of Sanok, but no matter how far I went, the food was still generally awful. 8 weeks into the assignment, I had lost almost 15 pounds. The food situation was one of many signs of how dire everything was in Poland. Autosan was a total mess and faced imminent disaster. Following the economic shock therapy implemented after the fall of communism, the Polish government canceled all of its orders for Autosan buses. The company had thus lost 90% of its sales and would either have to find an entirely new customer base or drastically cut costs. Finding new customers would be next to impossible because at the time, Autosan made some of the worst buses in the world. The only plausible option for them to avoid bankruptcy was to fire a lot of people. Given that the whole town depended on this company for its livelihood, this was the last thing they needed, and the last thing I wanted to tell them. The whole thing left me feeling sick, and my romantic notions of doing business in Eastern Europe were quickly starting to disappear. I didn't want to hurt these people. 3 weeks before the Christmas holidays, with my dread growing ever greater, I met Leszek for our ritual breakfast. I'd learned not to wander into ridiculous Samantha Fox-like conversations by simply being quiet, which he respected. in spite of our awkward start. I'd learned that Leszek was genuine and helpful, and after spending every day together for 2 months, I'd warmed to him. I felt sorry that he would be the one who had to translate my dire recommendations to the Autosan management team. And even more, I knew that when I finally left Sanok, I would actually miss him. That morning, as I picked at slices of pork sausage, I glanced across the table at Leszek's newspaper. He seemed to be perusing the personals, but then I looked closer. In little boxes were numbers, financial figures, surrounded by words I couldn't read. I leaned over and asked, "Leszek, what are those?"
"These are the very first Polish privatizations," he announced proudly.
I'd heard that Poland was privatizing its formerly state-owned companies, but I was so wrapped up in Autosan that I hadn't been following this at all. "That's interesting. What's that number?" I pointed to a figure near the top of the page.
"That's the share price."
"And this one?"
"The profit from last year."
"How about that one?"
"The number of shares being offered."
I did some quick math. The share price valued this company at $80 million, while the company's profits for the previous year were $160 million, which meant that the Polish government was selling this company for one half of the previous year's earnings. I was stunned. In simple terms, this meant that if you invested in this company and it stayed in business for 6 months, then you would effectively make your money back. I asked my questions again just to make sure that I wasn't missing anything, and I wasn't. This was extremely interesting. We went through the same exercise for some of the other companies in the newspaper, and the results were roughly the same. I'd never bought a single share in my life, but as I lay in bed that night, I couldn't stop thinking about the Polish privatizations. I thought, I need to do this. Isn't this exactly what I went to business school for? My net worth at the time was a total of $2,000. After checking with John Lindquist that there were no rules against my buying the shares, I decided to invest all my money in these privatizations. I had the cash wired to me in Poland, then asked Leszek if he could help me. During our lunch break, we went to the local savings bank and stood in line to convert the money to Polish zloty, then walked to the post office to fill out the subscription forms for the privatizations. The process was complicated and required Leszek to make 4 trips to the teller window to ask questions about how to fill out the detailed forms. But in the end, I subscribed to the first privatizations in Eastern Europe. In mid-December, I returned to London to prepare BCG's final presentation to Autosan and the World Bank, which we would make after the holidays. I was completely conflicted. My analysis showed that the company should fire a good part of the workforce if it wanted to stay in business. But after spending so much time with these people, I knew that mass layoffs would decimate them. I didn't know how some would survive. I thought about Leszek and his extended family, and I pictured the hardships they were already forced to endure. I had to recommend layoffs, but I wanted to soften the blow. I decided to couch the whole idea of firings as just one of the possible strategic options in our report, hoping the government would ultimately consider the other option, continuing to subsidize Autosan. But when I showed this softened presentation to Wolfgang in London, he was furious.
"What is this shit?"
"These are their options."
"What are you, stupid? They don't have any fucking options. They have to fire everybody, Browder."
He was being a complete bastard, but at least he got my name right. Wolfgang forced me to delete all the other strategic options, then had me pass the presentation off to another consultant to fix the analysis. BCG wound up recommending that Autosan fire the vast majority of its employees. We returned to Sanok, and Wolfgang insisted that I take the lead in presenting our findings. BCG, the World Bank, and Autosan's entire senior management gathered in the company's largest conference hall. The lights were dimmed, and I started up the projector, my transparencies ready to go. First, I put out the summary slide about the overall level of firings. The gasps were audible. I then described the layoff recommendations, department by department. Leszek nervously translated all of it. With every new slide, the shock diminished and the anger increased, and people started challenging me at every turn. The World Bank representatives looked at John and Wolfgang, hoping that they would intervene, but both avoided our clients' gazes and didn't say a word. When I was done, every person in the room glared at me. The general manager was notably quiet, eyeing me with a look of profound disappointment. I was supposed to have been Autosan's knight in shining armor, but instead I was a traitor. I was filled with a mixture of anger, self-doubt, and humiliation. Maybe Eastern Europe wasn't the place for me after all. I left Poland knowing one thing for certain, though. I hated consulting. Over the following months, I thought a lot about Autosan, wondering what had happened, and if I could have done anything differently. Communication with them was almost impossible. But later I got word that the Polish government had completely ignored BCG's recommendations and continued to subsidize Autosan. Normally, consultants hope that their advice is followed, but in this case, I was thrilled that it hadn't been. My only remaining connection to Poland was my investments, which I regularly checked. After leaving Sanok, they rose steadily. With every percentage point increase, I became more and more convinced that I had found my calling. What I really wanted to do was become an investor in the privatizations of Eastern Europe. As it turned out, I couldn't have been more right. Over the course of the following year, my investments would double, and then double again. Ultimately, they went up almost 10 times. For those who don't know, the sensation of finding a 10-bagger is the financial equivalent of smoking crack cocaine. Once you've done it, you want to repeat it over and over and over, as many times as you can.